Thank you, I guess. My name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. I'm glad you didn't remember that part because of my pitch, because I'm sure you'd have screwed it up. You know, some of you who've been subjected to my monologues in the past might wonder about this countdown. I dropped down just below 30, and yet I have been speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous on the average of twice a week for 37 years. Even when I had a slip, I didn't stop speaking. I felt I owed it to the newcomer. And someone mentioned here, too, how proud I am that I have opposed every improvement in AA for the last 37 years. And it keeps changing. We were talking about how sometimes our speakers get into the analytical aspects of isms and things like that, and we forget that our program essentially is based on the concept that no human power relieves alcoholism, that God could and would have thought and so on. And there's one rather devout fellow, I'll protect his anonymity and just call him Bill Roop. He reminds that back in the old days of the Oxford movement, before they got it straightened out, that you had to get down on your knees and accept the Lord as your personal Savior before you were allowed to go to a meeting. Now, of course, we have changed all of that because most of us come in resistant to any sort of ideology, dogma, credos, and so on, and I think it's very well that we have maintained it. And yet, what we do here, you know, we say this is a spiritual program, not a religious one. That's absolutely true. But the way we say it is sometimes as if we were implying that religions are not spiritual, which comes as a shock to the Catholic Church that has been struggling by for several centuries before we straightened it out. See, I have found absolutely nothing new in AA. I have read books written a millennia ago that were plagiarizing from our big book. It's simply that we don't put labels on it. Bill and I were talking about that, and someone talked to me about it last night. See, we have to be very careful we never use terminology that might be associated with Orthodox religions. In other words, we never say, yes, I went to a Wednesday night meeting and heard wonderful testimonial. We don't testify, we give pitches. You see, we don't backslide, we slip. We hit bottom, we don't die and be reborn again. But on the other hand, we give a birthday cake every year. And tonight, I guess, I didn't mean to get onto that kick, but I have never seen them do this sobriety bit again. And that's the one thing I think is perhaps missing. If we could just get the responses going. Who'll say amen to that? Who'll say God bless Bill Wilson? Who'll say don't take the first drink? I'm not entirely certain I'm going to be satisfied with my talk until someone drops down on the floor and speaks in tongues when I'm speaking. The closest I came to it was at a meeting in La Crescenta. A fella had a convulsion during the coffee break. And it was one of those meetings where they read everything and the leaders identified, which I always have regarded as absurd. I mean, when someone gets up and tells me he's an alcoholic, despite its stature today, it still isn't something you boast about to get ahead. Why you would qualify, it's like someone says he has a social disease. I don't say prove it. But they did all of those things here, and I was splitting a pitch with someone, and we kept dropping jewels from our talk. And then in the coffee break, this fella has a convulsion. You know, I was furious. I worked the steps, worked the steps. But I noticed that afterwards, the audience was particularly attentive. He hadn't been too articulate, but he was sure sincere. You know. I tried to arrange to have him travel with me, but unfortunately he got sober. I couldn't do it. I'm just doing filler till the people settle down here. I would like to thank the committee, too. Ordinarily, I'm not a convention type, and I haven't been seeing too much in Death Valley. They have a character who used to be a prospector there who would take off, and they wouldn't see him for months. He's known as Seldom Seen Slim. And I'm sort of like that at these conventions. I like to see the area, and I have spent the last few days touring and seeing Atlanta, and it's an incredibly beautiful city. I'm really truly impressed by it. The last time I think I was here filling in for Clancy, and that was a good thing too, because Clancy had this operation on his throat, and when he heard I'd filled in for him, he quit smoking. He didn't know what sort of heresy might be loose if that occurred. But it was in sometime in the fall, I think it was like a sauna. But this time it was truly beautiful, and I'm into running. I don't think you can really appreciate a city until you've seen it through a veil of perspiration and pain. And moderation is a rumor to me. Anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. I got through the male menopause racing motorcycles with Steve McQueen. And how can you tell how fast you can make a turn until you make it so fast you go on your butt? But I went out, and I think I ran every trail along the Chattahoochee River for the next umpteen miles, and I charged up the back of Stone Mountain. But I don't know how many of you have gone up the back of Stone Mountain, but in California, we are always annoyed because there's so much graffiti around. But at least it's with spray cans. As you go up the back of Stone Mountain, people have actually taken chisels up there, you know, and hacked things they should be ashamed of, like their names in there. I assume they're not Southern people. They're probably descendants of General Sherman and those other devils. But it's been absolutely most enjoyable. I really have appreciated it. And I should get a couple of things out of the way probably here. In the first place, one fellow came up to tell me that I had sentenced him to some durance vile as a judge in Los Angeles, and that's not true. It turned out he was mistaken. I'm in the appellate courts, and I will never have anything to do with at the trial level. But if you're ever convicted of a felony in California, don't hesitate to appeal. It won't do you an earthly bit of good, but it gives us something to do. I've heard Clancy and I remember Clancy when he came on the program. I'd been sober a couple of years at that time. And, you know, this higher power we have uses whatever talents we have. And Clancy, when he first came around, was a toothless, flim-flam man who could talk people into virtually anything. And over the years, I have watched him change. He now has teeth. But the strange thing is that he talks and he tells so much about himself, and yet we don't believe it. When he talks about feeling inferior, if he feels someone is trying to be one up on him, it hurts him, and he retaliates by striking back. And we listen to it and nod, you know, and think, isn't it nice that a person as brilliant and articulate as that should pretend to be mortal just like the rest of us? But the thing is, what he's saying is the truth. We are used in particular ways. And Clancy, it amazes me. I heard him talking there last night. See, my office now is in the new state building, and it's part of the redevelopment project there in Los Angeles. So it's right in the middle of Skid Row. And as he mentioned, it was going to be called the Ronald Reagan State Office Building until they printed it out and saw that it said Ronald Reagan SOB. So it's been shortened now to the Ronald Reagan Building. But it's true. And one time in a talk, I mentioned how I could now throw a wine bottle out my chamber window and hit where I used to sell blood. And then I had to carry on and said, and if I can get a little loft on it, I can hit Clancy over to Midnight Mission. I intended this as a respectful thing. You don't attack people you don't like and are fond of. But it actually hurt Clancy. And it's strange to me because when I write a decision and publish it now, it becomes binding law on 30 million people. It appears in every large law library in the United States and is precedent. And yet I don't believe for one second that I have done nearly as much to touch mankind, the American people, as Clancy. Clancy works with the hopeless, those who are beyond salvation he can work with. He gets down. There was a time when if I had a newcomer that I couldn't answer his questions, I couldn't even understand them. I would take him over to Clancy's house late at night and leave him on the front porch, push the doorbell and run. And Clancy would work with him day and night for the next 2 or 3 years until the fellow began to see through Clancy, and then I would take him back and make a gentleman out of him. But without question, I regard him as the most incredible speaker and innovative person I have ever seen. And yet, as with all of us, what we are talking about is our own perspective. You know, we can't see anything other than our own case in large measure. That's why I dislike it when people get up and they tell their story and then they say, and that's what we're like. You know, you've heard that people do that. Yes, and then I stripped stark naked and ran through the civic center, but you know, that's what we're like. You know, and then I went home and beat my wife. But you know what we're like. That's not what we're like. That's what you're like. Each of us has a story that will fit our own particular use. The things that Clancy talks about as his feelings and so on, you know, feeling uncertain about yourself, feeling that you may not be able to compete successfully. Remember, he's describing a feeling that he had before he started drinking. Now, there's a short term for that sort of a feeling. It's called adolescence. Adolescence is a form of insanity. We all begin to drink, most of us, I'm not all, but obviously most of us began to drink in our teens. Now, when people say I wasn't a happy child, that's redundant. Childhood is horror. You know, we sometimes say alcoholics are born without copers. You know, the implication is that non-alcoholics are born with copers. Have you ever looked in a crib and seen that little red-faced monster? When he wants something, whether it's to have his diaper changed or to be fed, he wants it right now, and he doesn't give a damn whether it's inconvenient or otherwise. He's got a coper? He doesn't. And for the next at least 15 to 20 years, he's going to be told that almost everything he does is wrong and should be restricted and curtailed. How could you possibly arise at adolescence without feeling somehow you're not quite enough when you've been told, don't do that, for 15 years or more? And alcohol is a great preservative. You know, you put a specimen into a bottle of alcohol, come back 10, 20 years later, it's still there, unchanged, unmarred. You put alcohol into an adolescent, come back 15 or 20 years later, still there. Well, I mean, he may have wrinkled, his hair may have grayed, he may have been educated beyond his intelligence, but emotionally, it's like that teenager. Look at your adolescent. What a horrible thing. You have to constantly be proving yourself. And you've got to dress funny, but just like everybody else in your peer group. You know, I mean, what a horrible period. And we begin to drink at that stage. I've taken inventories, and the worst that I've discovered about myself was that I didn't finish growing up. And now I've had to grow up on the program. Now, these things didn't come in bursts of insight. I've never had my higher power speak to me through thundering voices from the heavens or burning bushes. In fact, when I got here, I was a very devout atheist. I believed in no God with a capital N and worshipped it. I used to read the scriptures, not because I was looking for solace, insight, or inspiration, but in order to have material with which to flagellate the Christians in those barroom discussions. And after I've been around, I've been doing it for a while, I realized that it wasn't necessary to read the Bible. Nobody else reads it. So you can just make it up as you go along. I mean, the only people who read it, Chuck Chamberlain and Bill Roop. So I would walk into a bar, sit down beside a pretty lady and say, "Blessed is she who welcomes a stranger unto her bed, Deuteronomy 9:17. You know, I mean, what does she know, Deuteronomy 9:17? But you've already got a spiritual leg up, as it were. I don't remember, like Clancy, I don't remember anything about the Depression. We went to school with no shoes, but so did everybody in our neighborhood. It wasn't anything big to me. I worked steadily since I was 13 years old. I'm a worker. I don't understand people who can run and flee. You know, Clancy talks in his stories about when things got tough, he split. I could never run. That was impossible. The only person I think I ever identified with in the motion pictures was Cool Hand Luke. You know, there was just a failure to communicate with me. I could not run. And people give me credit sometimes for things I don't deserve. As I say, I've been steadily employed, except when locked up, because I have to work. Now, I know newcomers. I've told them over and over again, no one has died in California literally of starvation since the 30s. Malnutrition, gone without food, but no one has literally starved since the 30s, whereas hundreds of thousands have died of alcoholism. So don't worry if you get a job. It doesn't matter. You're not going to starve. And I tell them that, and they believe it, and it works, because I've seen it work repeatedly in their lives. But I know it wouldn't work for me. I know if I were unemployed for more than 3 days, I would starve. See, I don't work out of virtue. I work out of terror. Yeah, I visualize the scene. I've been walking the streets looking for employment. I have my briefcase. I'm in my Hickey Freeman suit. And as I come home around the pool in my backyard, stand my children, eyes dark, bellies bloated. "Bread, Daddy, bread for the love of God." You know, these are character defects. My first inventory, when I listed my character defects, I later discovered those were my few virtues. But our higher power takes care of all of these things. Suppose there really were a power that could look out into the universe and see the myriad incredible universes and galaxies that are without number, could look within the heart of an atom and see the spiraling atoms and electrons and quarks and all the things they now know of, who could mark the fall of a sparrow. Suppose there really were such a thing. Would you have to tell it what you need? Would you have to explain to it? When I first sobered up, I couldn't get a job. I hit L.A. I couldn't get a job. It was impossible because I was on probation for felonious assault. I had to see a psychiatrist 3 times a week as a condition of probation. It's hard to find employment like that. You know, you walk in, they say, "What was your last job?" "Well, I was a chief trial deputy in the district attorney's office, you know. But I can't be working full. I have to take each morning off 3 times a week." And somehow it's a little hard to explain all of this. I have to work. So I would go down to the railroad depots and get into shape-ups. If there weren't enough union men to unload the boxcars, they would pick out those among us who looked stalwart enough, and they would hire us. And I'd push a handcart all night. And then I would go out and maybe caddy at the golf courses in the daytime, because I had to work. Now, I don't know anything about golf. I come from the backwoods of Oregon, but I can tell you that was once humiliating. You know, I don't know if you any before they had golf carts, you had caddies, you know, and you'd have 2 huge bags on your long, you know, and the guy would say, "Hey, boy, how far to that next green?" "Hey, boy." I say my last job had been in the DA's office. You know, I felt like dropping the bag. "How the hell would I know? Put your hands up against the tree. I'll shake it down, you son of a..." But I finally got a job working for the Southern Pacific in Santa Fe. Well, actually, started off working for the Santa Fe Railroad as a mud hop, which meant that I got up and I would walk between the cars and note down the type of car and its number. And I would walk up and down all night long as they brought the cars in. I would write down the kind of car and the number. And I got every one right. I mean, 9 years of college counts for something. And so I was promoted, and I was made the head of the interchange between the Southern Pacific and the Santa Fe, which meant I had a little tiny metal shack underneath the North Broadway Bridge, for any of you who know Los Angeles. And I was delighted. I was grateful. But by this time, I was speaking in AA. As I say, I was the main speaker in my second AA meeting. Never confuse glibness with sincerity, knowledge, or insight. And so I would speak at a meeting, give them a little touch of pathos, give them a little humor, end on a rising note of hope, split and go down, put on my shoes, and walk the railroad tracks. You know, I felt like Cinderella. Midnight, I turned into a pumpkin. And I began to be annoyed with this. How long, O Lord, how long must I, humble servant, shuffle along in these vineyards while those shysters downtown wax bats? And then it dawned on me, it's highly unlikely that the heads of some large corporation or the senior partners in a major firm were going to be driving along over the North Broadway Bridge after midnight and saying, why don't we look down there? Maybe we'll find that new house console we want. I realized that I had to get out and expose myself if I wanted to get a job. And I realized then also that the Serenity Prayer doesn't say it is more serene to accept everything. You know, sometimes people use it as if it meant we had to accept everything. And really, it doesn't say that. It says, what do we serenely accept? Those things we cannot change. We change the things we can. So if I wanted to get out from under there, I decided I had to expose myself. I had to go into at least one law firm, talk to the people. No matter how, if it was too startling and traumatic, I wouldn't go back for another week, but at least I would then be able to do one or the other. And for many years, I told that about that, how if you're in a situation that you can't serenely accept, then by golly, you better change it, no matter how frightening, terrifying it is. On the other hand, if you're in a situation that you simply cannot change for some reason or other, you better set out to serenely accept it. You must do one or the other. It isn't that one is more noble. It's simply that if you don't, it's like you're sitting with your buttocks into the apex of a volcano with a pressure building, and boom! Eventually it goes and takes your sobriety with you. And I thought this was a marvelous message. I used to talk about it. But that was not how I got out from under the Broadway Bridge. I got out from under the Broadway Bridge because one night, about 3 a.m, the phone rang. I had 2 telephones, 1 to each company. But the phone rang, and it was some attorney who had heard me speak, and he had a large case, and he was not familiar with trial work, and he asked, would I come out and try the case for him? In other words, they did come into the under the Broadway Bridge after midnight. Everything is going to be taken care of here. Not in your time, but it's like I have newcomers, particularly the young ones, you know, and they're all anxious. They've got to get a girl, and they've got to manipulate, and they've got to do this and that. I tell them, if you work a good program, don't worry. You could go to bed and just stay there. Someone will climb in with you. But as I say, these things didn't come to me quickly or easily. Several people, in fact, the committee said something about not paying for the airfare if I didn't tell one story. It's terrible having to tell these things, but tapes make it bad, too. You finally think you have a virgin audience, and people come up and say, make sure you tell a story where you made a boob of yourself. But the particular one, you see, up until a certain point in my life, I never identified the problems I had with alcohol, because it's almost impossible to come into conflict with society without some member of society participating. In other words, if he hadn't have made a left turn, I wouldn't have hit him, which is true, but if I hadn't have been an unguided missile going down the street, I might have seen he was making the left turn about a block earlier. Or if he hadn't said what he said about our beloved president, I wouldn't have a broken nose. Which again is true, but if I had not been bombed, he might not have made his point quite so smashingly. But I could always blame someone. And then this particular incident, which I've described because it was an insight to me, occurred. See, I used to drink largely, almost exclusively, to relax. And on this particular occasion, I'd been relaxed maybe 5-6 days. And I awakened from a fitful sleep. Horrible, nightmarish dreams about Dante's Inferno, imps of the perverse. I could almost smell the sulfur. You know, and I staggered to my feet, and I found I was literally drenched with perspiration. You know, I couldn't figure out what had happened. I looked about the room, naturally, and quickly got my bearings, and I then saw what the trouble was, because I had nodded off on a couch. My family having retired to wherever it was they used to go at night, and from this couch, there was a little hole that emanated a little spire of smoke. And so I knew what the problem was. I had apparently nodded off with a cigarette either in my hand or mouth, and it had fallen onto the plastic covering, that outer tack matting that is on a couch, and gotten through into the actual tacking inside. There, lacking oxygen to take flame, the embers had slowly spread over the course of the night until they now covered most of the bed. And so I realized there was nothing wrong with my drinking. I had just been barbecued. So, commending myself for my perspicacity, I went out into the kitchen. I got a big pitcher of water, came back and tried to pour it into that tiny little hole, producing a rather spectacular cascade on the carpet, but little else. And so I knew more dramatic and stringent measures were called for. I went back into the kitchen. I returned to the butcher knife. I slashed it from one end to the other, opened up the embers, and then was able to subdue them with the cooling balm of the water. The only thing was that I also produced a great deal of acrid black smoke. Now, this has been half a century ago, and yet I can still remember standing there, eyes watering, looking down at that slashed and sodden mass, and realizing that almost to a certainty, my wife was going to notice it. She was a very keen-eyed woman. There was little that passed her ken around that house, I'll tell you. And she was a good woman, certainly never one who would do anything to assail her husband's leadership, attack his masculinity as head of the household. But there were times in moments of vexation, let us say, where she would lose herself and say things that later she would be very deeply sorry about. And I wanted to spare her this. You know, she might say something, sometimes actually things that were unkind, cruel even, like, "You drunken son of a bitch, you did it again, didn't you?" And so I wanted to spare her, but I didn't know what to do. And I thought, well, the only thing I could think of was to get the couch out of the house. I mean, out of sight, out of mind. You might vaguely remember there had been something on that side of the room. The only thing is, it isn't really easy to move a bed couch when you should be checking into a sanitarium. But with that Herculean strength that comes only to the panic-stricken alcoholic, I somehow managed to heft that brute onto my shoulders and lurched out through the front door. At that time, we were living on the second floor of an apartment that had a very small porch with columns. I remember I almost beat myself to death caroming as I tried to make the turn. Bung, 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 bung. But finally, I managed to get downstairs, and then I realized that foresight had not been my long suit. It is virtually impossible to find a place to conceal a couch in the typical apartment patio. And so I'm standing there, legs trembling. I should be in a hospital, but I'm moving furniture. And I remembered a creek about 5 miles away. So I staggered to my car, and I hefted that brute up on top of it, and then got in to drive to my selected place of repose. Now, all I have ever wanted in life was dignity. I have not caviled at disaster when I could face it with dignity. But as I drove down the street, by this time, I don't know what hour it was, but it was daylight now. There were people at the bus stops on the corners with briefcases and lunch pails. I have no idea how they can stay up that late, but they're out there. And as I drove down the street, I noticed that their heads all turned and followed my progression. Eyes wide, jaws agape. You know, I thought, by golly, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California, I'll say that. Until I chanced to pass an auto dealership that had a dusty window that acted like a mirror. And I got a picture of what they were looking at. Here was a fellow with about a week's growth of beard, nattily attired in a bathrobe. He's driving down the street in a car on which rests a couch, which previously had not had enough oxygen to take flame, but going down the street, the wind was going through it like a billows, and the flames were 30, 40 feet in the air. And when I got back to the house, for the first time, I couldn't find anybody to blame for that. I really could not blame my sleeping wife and children for having imperiled their lives as they had. And I thought, maybe something is amiss. But that's enough of the drinking. Let's say that subsequently I was to move beyond social drinking. In fact, in the terminal stages of my drinking, I wasn't even getting into trouble anymore. How much trouble can you get into in a hotel room with a bottle of wine and a copy of Playboy? The maid doesn't step on you, you're relatively safe. The only thing is you can't move. And then you remember AA. You know, and the things that they tell us in here, I used to do a bit about the steps and, you know, pointing out that even in the vision, there's nothing in AA that appeals to the intellect. See, the first step talks about admitting you're powerless. It doesn't say you admit you're an alcoholic. It says you admit you're powerless. That's quite different. I read the AA book when I was quite young, and I realized then that alcoholics were different than other people. But that didn't make me powerless. If you can still control when you're going to start drinking and when you're going to finish, you're not powerless. I would come out of a courtroom and the other attorney might say, well, let's see. What do you say we stop and have a beer, Don? You know, had a tough day. And I'd say, well, let's see, I can't. Today's Tuesday. I have to be back in court on Thursday. You know, they look at you strange, you see, but if you can predict your behavior, you are not powerless. And so the first step, you know, is terrible. I'm writing over here in the plane on the Delta flight. There's a magazine article in there and its caption is, I think it was captioned, winners never quit and quitters never win. And I thought, that guy's not an alcoholic, I'll tell you. Okay, but the idea of powerlessness, that's an awful admission. Most of us are incapable of it. You know, we're told if you don't succeed at first, try again. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. Never say die, et cetera, et cetera. And they're saying you're going to have to admit that you're powerless, like some leaf caught in a passing wind, twisted, turned, deposited where the leaf would. You have nothing to say about it. I mean, that is not something that appeals. The second and third steps, they're even worse because they're talking about God, you know, a concept that most of us have rejected. We're asked to step off into a void to be supported by something we know to be non-existent. You know, that doesn't appeal to the intellect. The fourth step, I understood that. As an attorney, I didn't put anything down in writing without a considerable reflection. And when I did, it was not going to be a list of my sins, crimes, felonies, acts of disloyalty, and breaches of trust. That's the first thing they tell you in law school never to do, nor allow a client to do. That isn't a way to avoid problems. That's the way to ensure them. Or if you did them in order to have some patterns that you might see in your life, surely then, having looked upon them, you would take those shameful sheets, burn them, stomp the ashes into the dust, would you not? No. A says you immediately run to some blabbermouth, tell them all about it, lay yourself open to a lifetime of sure blackmail. And if you did these crazy things, you would then get to steps 8 and 9, where you get to make amends to them after all the rotten things they did to us. We make amends to them. You know, I don't know there weren't enough people here to noon or 2 o'clock to hear that show they put on. That was magnificent. You guys could skip Clancy and you could skip me, but you really should have made that. But they used every truism. They went through the steps in musical form and it was absolutely magnificent. But they were talking about that, making amends to those people. How they smote us, the 99 blows, and if we retaliated with a backhand slap once, we have to make amends to them. When I got here, I couldn't think of a single person to make an amend to. I could not. You know, and it troubled me. I thought, you're not perfect, are you? I mean, it didn't seem probable, but all the evidence pointed in that direction. And I finally thought of one person, and I sat down and dictated a letter. It read something like, Dear Sir, I joined an organization which is part of its discipline, requires that if any way I've hurt or offended another human being, I should promptly apologize. Therefore, I wish to say I'm sorry that I shot you. If I can be of further service to you in the future, however, please do not hesitate to call upon me. Now, that's 30 or more years ago. That guy hasn't even responded. It's a shame, really, the way they carry grudges. Subsequently, however, I thought of others to make amends to. Everybody I ever met. we go through life cutting such a swath of horror, it's almost unbelievable. And we do it with the most noble and high intentions. I mean, associating with an alcoholic who's practicing is something like fondling a frog or a toad. You know, the best you can hope for is warts. It's just awful. But if you went through them all, you got to step 12, which, as I then read it, said, if I would do this, I would then be entitled to get up at 3 in the morning to call on some drunkard who's going to puke on my shoes. I thought, that's a soft sell. And the more I drank, the more I hated drunks. The more weak I became, the more I hated weakness in others. And now I'm going to devote my life to this? I remember reading on into the vision for you. I thought there might be a little more appeal here. Visions sometimes have that characteristic. There they say, if you will do they call it quaintly, putting your house in order. Say, surely you will meet with some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. I thought, trudge? Trudge. Of all the verbs in the English language that can be used to describe locomotion, they picked out trudge. I mean, that's straight out of Rudyard Kipling. Boots, 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 marching up and down again, foot slogging over Africa. There's no end to the war. When I was younger, I'd sometimes have somebody come to me and say, you come with me, fella, I'm a swinger. I never meant to say, you come with me, I'm a trudger. You know, but the solution to that is to keep drinking. When you end up in that hotel room and can't get out of it, you think of those people down there who are trudging. Oh, boogie! I mean, that's real locomotion when you're in four-point restraint, vomiting straight up. For some reason, flashback on me, Clancy last night talked about his family. And I have never talked about my family. Clancy usually doesn't either. But again, we have families. Most children are so damn selfish that they really don't think in terms of what the family is like until they do, as Clancy said, get into an analysis of it. You know, I come from an ordinary sort of a family. My mother was a Pentecost and my father was a communist. Fortunately, I can remember one time, one of my earliest memories, riding down a country road in a Model T, and we came upon a rabbit that had been hit by a preceding car. And looking out there at this little bundle of fluff and blood and entrails, I was touched, and my mother said, Oh, Donald, see the poor bunny rabbit lying dead in the road. And my father, perhaps seeing a tear beginning to form in the corner of my infantile eye, said, All right, Donald, sing along with me. See the dead rabbit, clap hands, see the dead rabbit, clap hands. Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with alcoholism. It may explain why I'm never quite certain how to respond to given stimuli. But alcoholism is a phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. The book tells us the only thing we have in common, one with the other, is the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. These other things have nothing to do with that. You don't have to be crazy or emotionally disturbed in order to be an alcoholic. You know, we haven't had 10 people walk on the face of the moon. Yes, we have. Now, we had about 10 people walk on the face of the moon. One of them's already in AA. No. They check those guys pretty good. They're not wired right. They don't shoot them out. I don't know if you ever heard him speak. He gives a good talk. He said, well, if what I heard him say, or what he would say if he was witty enough. But he talks about how he steps off into the dust of the moon, looks back at that little blue-white globe we call the Earth, and for the first time, panic struck him. He thought, I'm 180,000 miles from the nearest liquor store. Yeah, but my family separated when I was very young, and I don't remember my father at all. I'm sure I was impressed by him, but molded. But when I was in the first or second grade or so, he had gone, and I had no conscious memory of him until I met him later as an adult. I had a drunken stepfather, but again, it didn't impress me that much. Obviously, there's a certain amount of terror listening to things that go bump in the night and realizing they're your parents. but like all youth that I know, I was too selfish really to be too concerned with all of that. I like Clancy talking about getting close to his father. I couldn't do that in that sense. See, in my family, emotions were to be controlled, not indulged. I remember going into the Army. It was such a moving thing during the war years that my mother forgot herself, and we shook hands very firmly. If we touched in the hall, we apologized. You just didn't display emotion. You know, it's funny, if you can't display emotion, there is a tendency to find release in drinking. There's no question about that. And I could not, until I came into AA, tell you how I felt at an appropriate time. I remember once I was stationed in the Air Corps in Yuma, Arizona, briefly, and it's rather dull in Yuma, Arizona. And this was a Sunday, and the greatest excitement going on was the fact I was playing a game of chess with somebody in the barracks. And naturally, the other members gathered around to see this exciting event. And there sat down beside me a fella eating an apple. Now, all of my life, I've had a fixation about mouth noises. Not because of any gentility by nature, but because perhaps my mother said, don't slurp your soup, Donald, or something. And so I can't abide mouth noises. And I sat down, and I was pondering my move and about to make it when this guy took a bite of the apple. I thought, thank God I am not as other men are. But I was always spiritual, even in those days. I said, three God grant me's, and went back, made my move. My opponent replied in time. I was about to move again. We took another bite. I thought, dress a monkey as you will. He remains a monkey still. But having the patience of Job, and certainly not one to indicate emotion or reaction, I made my move. My opponent replied. I was about to move again when he brought the apple up to his mouth for yet another bite. I stood up and I backhanded him as hard as I could, right in the mouth. Wow! Shoved that damn apple into his face. The seeds were beginning to trickle out of his nose. He was choking over the sweet meat. And here I was standing above him. I made one goddamn move. I was going to co-cock him. I'm afraid he was going to get up and hurt me. And when he finally had his larynx cleared sufficiently to have once more the power of speech, he asked a rather pertinent question. He said, why did you do that? Well, I am always one who's willing to explain a problem, a situation, reason. And so I said to him, somebody give me that. You come on, I kill you. And he asked then another question that was rather forthright and pertinent. He said, well, if I was disturbing you, why didn't you ask me to stop? And I said, I didn't want to hurt your feelings, you dumb son of a bitch. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, most people would rather have their feelings abraded than an apple thrust up their nose in front of a room full of people. See, but if you cannot display negative, hostile emotions, which are acceptable in the male, How are you going to explain tenderness? Loving kindness. This can't be done. So I had great difficulty with this program, and great difficulty with higher power, as I mentioned. On my first insight into that, I sometimes told about. I had a little boy after I came back on the program. And he was born into my age, as it were. My other children, who had lived through my drinking years, had, I thought I had lost them, thought I'd ruined their lives. Turned out it wasn't the case, but I thought that. And here was this little guy, and I was more like a grandfather to him, I think. I had time for him. With the other kids, I was busy and learning and developing, and they'd come around and say, "Daddy, will you play with me?" And I said, "Get the hell out of the way, I'm reading a book on how to be a good father." But this little guy, you know, I had all the time in the world for him. And on this particular occasion, he liked to play outside. But it was an autumn day, and he was about a year old then, and just able to toddle around. And in order to take him out into the cool air, I had to garb him. I had to dress him for this little journey. I don't know if any of you have recently done or have ever done, but let me remind those of you who have. When you're trying to put a child into a play suit, their fingers grow horny tentacles that get caught in the webbing as you're trying to put their arm down to sleep. Put your damn thumb down. I don't want to play outside. I don't want to play. I reason with them thus. And he's kicking and thrashing about, you know. And I finally get him dressed. And I take him out and I stand him out in the middle of the greensward. Is he humbly grateful for the good that I have brought to bear in his life? Not through his idea, not through his encouragement, not even through his cooperation, but over his stout resistance. He is not. He began to swagger off. If he could have snapped his fingers, he'd have done it. I mean, his attitude was, about time things are beginning to break for me. I mean, he was taking credit for it. And the horrible part was, I identified. Because here was I, who had been in the absolute depths, and now I had this lovely child, a beautiful wife, back in my profession, and I was beginning to snap my fingers. About time things are beginning to break for me. I was taking credit. You know, and I realized then, that little child is absolutely powerless. You know, an infant like that could not survive a week if he did not have a power greater than himself. He didn't know how to prepare food, how to consume it. He would have died of starvation within days. He didn't know how to protect himself, shield himself from the storms, garb himself from the winds. He knew nothing. He'd have died of exposure within hours if he didn't have a power greater than himself. He didn't know what things in his little world were dangerous and how to tend his wounds should he get them. You remember your little children? He'd rush toward the hot stove, and if you stop him, he doesn't know he's being lovingly protected. He knows he's being thwarted. Let me at it. Of course, if he breaks free and touches it, then he remembers, "Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" No. And I realized that this child's life was absolutely dependent on a higher power, a power greater than himself, and he had one. It was me. Not me, Don, but me, an adult. I was his higher power, and I loved him just this side of idolatry. And yet I could not communicate to his infantile mind my plans for him. There was no way I could tell him what I had in store for him. And it suddenly dawned on me that if there was this higher power I talked about earlier, who could understand the universe, the atom, could he possibly communicate, could it possibly communicate with me and tell me what it had in store for me? Clearly not. And yet, just like my child, all of my life, everything good that has occurred to me was preceded by a preparatory period of pain. You know, I have never left a situation voluntarily. They had to throw me out. "I hate your guts, but you're the only woman I know tonight." You know. And it dawned on me that it is just possible there is a higher power. And I'll bet if he is, then just like with my son, he wants nothing but the very best for me. And from that moment on, I have tried to relax and pull my thumbs in when there's adversity and allow them to slide through the preparatory suits that we seem to have. My life has been extremely rich, extremely good. I've done all kinds of wild and crazy things. The latest insight into alcoholism is that it's caused by a deficiency in the body's ability to produce endorphins. Endorphins are that endogenous morphine that you come in moments of stress. Non-alcoholics don't seem to have that, so we have greater ups and more horrible downs, and you know, we don't seem to be shielded by it. You can produce endorphins in other ways, however. You don't have to get drunk to do it. Running will do it. I had to quit. This, by the way, I know it's tough for you social smokers, but for those of us who couldn't handle it and smoke to excess, what a godsend it is to be. Yeah, it is amazing. I come from the backwoods of Oregon, as I say, where we used to shoot deer and hang the venison out in a smoke shed behind the house all year round. So I know what smoke does to raw meat. But for 35 years, I made lung jerky. Finally had to quit. Doctor gave me a mantra to repeat, emphysema. And when you're ready to quit, it's a cinch. Don't worry about it. You get on your knees, you bark like a dog for a week, and other than that, it's nothing. But they told me to get into running. Now that, of all the horrors in life, if I had to list the 10 most despicable things one can imagine, I wouldn't have even thought to put down running. It's too awful. All my life I've been punished by running. In sports, they made you run laps if you goofed off. In the Army, they made you double time. The idea that one would do a thing like that voluntarily. So they sent me out to run. And I trudged along for 50 feet and, you know, and kept it up. We have a thing for pain. And pretty soon I got where I could run a whole mile and then 2 miles. And I was leaving to go speak at a meeting, and I caught myself skipping as I went down the walkway. I didn't skip as a boy. I've been called Mr. Gates since I was 13. I allow my intimates to call me sir. And I'm skipping. I thought, God, I hope the neighbors didn't see that. And I thought, what's wrong with you? And I realized there's nothing wrong with me. I had just done something that was good for my body, and my body was resulting rewarding me by kicking loose a bunch of endorphins. I was high. Now, see, no one had ever communicated with me on that level. They had told me that running was good for me, which I construed as a threat.
You know what's good for you?
They hadn't told me it would make me feel good. You can imagine what happened then. I mean, if 2 miles will make you feel good, how about 4, 8, 16? I mean, within a year, I was up to half marathons. I had a stress fracture in both feet, bursitis in the back, my hip gave out. I didn't have a moment free from pain after I got healthy. See, but the body recovers and rebuilds itself. It's astonishing. I've run 5 marathons now. That's a long way. I don't recommend it, but I'm just saying that anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. And the strange thing is, every race I was ever in, I won. From 5K up to marathons. I don't mean I came in first. I haven't the faintest idea what's going on up in the front of the pack where those fanatics are. See? But in the races that I'm in, they have categories. They break you down by age, by sex, sometimes by occupation. I have continued to refine my category till I'm the only one who's in it. Okay, so when I finish, I win. That's really not as idiotic as it sounds, because as a practical matter, we are the only ones in our category. We're not competing against anybody else in a run or in life. You're not competing against me. When you finish you play the game, finish the race, you win. Drop out, start using again, you're a loser. I mean, it's that simple. And life has been so darn good. I promised, I'm sorry, I swore I was going to get off here in time, and I'll bet I'm running over, I don't know. But I promised I'd tell 2 things. When I talk about all the good things that have happened to me, and they have been incredibly good, I've had an exciting life. I got trophies. I won racing motorcycles. I got through the male menopause racing motorcycles with Steve McQueen, as I mentioned. I've run marathons. I've done free fall parachute jumping. I learned to be a pilot and got a pilot. I mean, everything that I could think of. If you are bored with life, it tells nothing about life. It tells something about you. You're very boring. Because it's exciting, it's wild out there, and the thing to do is to get out and do it. Now, we're only here for a brief time, 50 years. Everybody in this room, virtually, even the young ones, are going to be dead. We rise like bubbles in champagne, pop, and we're gone. And this is the only time to do anything. If you wanted to help society produce and advance a cause, this is the only time you can do it. Nobody raises their hand for righteousness' sake in the tomb. If you want to do something loving, tender, gentle, lewd, lurid, this is the only time, too. Another poet said, the grave, it is a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. This is the only time we have. So, and I have had such a wondrous life. And yet, I'm talking, tragedy is going to occur. I don't want to frighten the newcomers off by making them think they're going to be happy all the time. A life free from cause for complaint would be horrible to a newcomer. But take consolation. Things are going to happen to you on this program that will curl your hair. Things are going to happen that are more horrible than you can presently imagine. There will be times when you will seem to be surrounded by a cylinder of pain in which there's neither door nor seam. There is no escape, and you just stand there and hurt because you forfeited your right to chemical peace of mind. And then one day, the wall falls away and you see the world as you never saw it before. And you never feel guilty anymore when good things occur. I always felt guilty when I had something good occur. I don't feel that anymore. But tragedy is bound to occur. I've had a series of it in the last year or so. I snapped at one of our committeemen, perhaps because of it. About one of the reasons my wife isn't here, a couple of years ago, somebody burglarized our house and she came home and interrupted them. He smashed her in the face, broke all the bones in her face, took two plastic surgeries to put her back together. She got 25 years of sobriety. He wasn't looking for me, as it turned out, as the police thought originally. It was just some guy loaded on crack and needed a fix. He picked our house. Why not? Somebody might say, why should that happen? Why should that happen to someone who's trying to devote their life to helping people like that? Why not? Why not? Maybe we're even in a better position to understand it than somebody else. And the horrible thing is, when he comes on the program, he's going to tell, I hope he does make the program, he'll tell a story that we'll laugh at. We laugh at the tragedies. He'll tell us, yeah, I just got loaded, you know, and I needed to fix him, so I just picked out a house. You know, my luck, I not only hit a judge's house, I hit an appellate court judge's house. And then his wife came home, and I hit her and put her in the hospital. Ha ha! I don't know if I'm going to laugh, but I will not sponsor him. Yeah, but that was a tough thing. And then a little over a year ago, in a town a little further north where my stepmother lived, somebody burglarized her house. She's 84 years old, and he raped her. He grabbed her by the face, and she just had cataract surgery and fouled up her eyes. Last year, a short while ago, someone burglarized my mother's house. She lives a little further north in a town where everybody, except one person, apparently, took help and loved her and took care of her. He burglarized her house and murdered her. See, life doesn't... The universe does not stand up on tippy toes because I stopped sucking on a jug. All the things that flesh are heir to are going to happen to us on this program. You're not going to escape life here. You're going to live it. And live it to the fullest, I hope, because most of it is going to be so incredibly good. I promised I would tell one story. Apparently, I must have told it the last time I was here because somebody asked about it. But the miracle that is described here has been so true in my life. I was over in England about 5 or 6 years ago studying the English judicial system. And my wife, she went back to law school and passed the bar so she could criticize my decisions. Because I was the highest ranking of the judges, we were assigned to the courtroom in which Lord Farquharson was presiding. He's one of their high court judges. There, they make their high court judges there are made peers of the realm. They're knighted. They don't wear the humble black that we do. He asked us, would you like to take the bench with me this afternoon? We said, why, it would be an honor. And he said, well, I will have to don my raiment. You'll excuse me. You may find it a trifle ostentatious. They wear scarlet robes, beautiful crimson scarlet, with ermine around the collar and coming down the sides. They wear the large, full white wig, not the little freshman dink the barristers wear. They have buckles and sashes. I mean, I couldn't believe it. We walked out onto the bench. We looked like a moving Christmas tree. I mean, he was red and white, and I was just green with envy. But we got out there to try this case, and it's in an English courtroom, which is a high point of most judges, lawyers' goals. I mean, to sit there in the Old Bailey type of atmosphere with the black robed barristers and their little white dinks, and I'll put it to you, my lord, you know, it was unbelievable. And over in the dock was the fellow who was on trial. It happened to be a criminal case. And this was some years back. So 25 years earlier, this fellow was charged with felonious assault. 25 years earlier, I'd been in an American courtroom in handcuffs, charged with felonious assault. And now I'm sitting on the bench of an English courtroom with a lord. Can you imagine that? How can you possibly go from the blackness, the lockups, the darkness, the miserable, staggering drunkenness to sitting in an English courtroom with a lord? It couldn't happen. If you were to put that on television in a soap opera, they'd laugh you off the air. It's too utterly unrealistic. It is contrary to human experience, is what is the definition of a miracle. And yet in AA, that sort of thing happens all the time. Not that particular miracle, but one of equal magnitude. Heard a woman talk about how she had abused her children because she'd been abused, but in AA she broke it. She now has a loving relationship. I'd far rather see the cycle of child abuse than see some guy made a judge. But it is a miracle. And I thought about it at the time. I thought, how can you go from the dock to the bench? I have no idea, but I know exactly how to go back. I take the first drink. Thank you.